Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
This is 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city, and this is the Electric Drum. I'm Jose Candelario, and today I am joined by the superintendent of New Haven Schools, Dr. Madeline Negron. Tell me a little bit about your childhood and where you're from.
Ooh, you're asking a lot there. So, where am I from? I am a proud Boricua. That means that I am originally from the island of Puerto Rico. And I came to Connecticut at the age of 10, along with my family, my mom, my dad, my great-grandfather, and my three brothers. We made the trip together.
How was your childhood in Puerto Rico that you remember?
The childhood that I had in Puerto Rico, it was a good one in the sense that, you know, it was all about community, all about being together, you know, neighbors who, you know, grew up together. And more than neighbors, they become like your family, right? That kind of an environment. That aspect of it was good, but also very challenging, right? Coming in from, you know, a family that was struggling. My dad was struggling to provide for us. Both my mom and my dad come from large families. They're both the, my dad's the oldest on his side, and my mom is the second oldest on her side. And again, they grew up poor, and I grew up poor also. Have one older brother. When my parents share that when my brother was born, my older brother was born, things were a little better. Because my dad used to work for an American factory that was in the island, Las Salchichas Savoy. And with that, even though he didn't have a high school diploma or a college degree, at least he had a stable income through working in that factory. When that factory, like many other factories in Puerto Rico, decided to leave the island, my dad, not having high school diploma or a college degree, basically had no way of, you know, earning the kind of income that he was earning. And that was the period in which, you know, I was born and raised. So I got to see the struggles, right? My dad had to do like everything under the sun to earn money, whether that was sell piraguas, I remember he had a van. He would go campo through campo, like selling clothing. He did everything. Sell ice cream, you name it. And it wasn't cutting it. So he would often also be one of the migrant workers that the U.S. would recruit in the island to, you know, bring seasonal workers to New York and New Jersey. So my dad started doing a little bit of that with, I guess, an uncle of mine. And the two of them would come, work the fields, save money. He would go back home, pay the debt, pay the supermarket. Once the dollars ran out, he would come again, do the seasonal work. And eventually he said, you know what, this is not a way to raise a family, and made the decision for us to come.
What values did you gain from your father growing up and watching his tenacious attitude?
Listen, I think often people, you know, they say, you're like, who's your hero? And I know this sounds corny, but for me, it's my dad. Because my dad, with all the struggles that he had, he could have taken the easy way out. There are other ways to make money. He never went down that path. My dad was like, no job is beneath me, right? He would do any job. Like, I remember when we came to Connecticut, We moved into Willimantic because that's where my maternal grandparents were. So we went to Windham Heights. We all, you know, crammed in one apartment, everybody sleeping everywhere. And my dad worked for the egg farm. He later worked for, you used to call them Los Palitos, you know, planting trees. He would come home like late at night, exhausted. And I remember my mom saying like, oh my God, just like, at least like, just take off your boots, leave them there, because just the smell would like come into the house. But that's what my dad did, because that's what a father does. A father provides for his family. And that's what my dad did. So I would say my dad's a hero. Hmm.
Your mom there, supportive?
So my mom had always been a homemaker when we lived in Puerto Rico, right? Her job was to, you know, raise the family. She had never worked one day in her life. And when we moved to Connecticut, you know, my mom, you know, had to work. Fortunately enough, my dad became a cleaning lady, you know, cleaning the dorms up at UConn. So that was a good job that she had. Again, no high school diploma, no college degree, had never worked a day in her life. And when she comes, eventually lands a job cleaning the dorms. And thank God, because that meant that she could have retirement. And now they went back to Puerto Rico. And that's where I get to go visit them every so often.
So you come here as a teenager, right? Mm-hmm. You're 10 years old. How was the culture shock? Because now the education system is different, and so is society.
That was hard. That was hard. And I have to kind of give you lots of details there. So I came at the age of 10. So all I knew was, right, this culture where you get up, you walk down to your escuelita. So I would walk down with my older brother to the escuelita. You know, you move from classroom to classroom. You have your recess outdoor. Lunchtime, you walk back up home. Mom has lunch ready, and then you walk back down to school, right? Open campus. And now here I am, time to go to school. I don't speak the language. First time I ever have to go to a bus stop, get onto a bus. That was the scariest experience ever, getting on that bus. I recall vividly, I get on that bus, bus stops, there's this brick building that I was going to walk into. Kramer Middle School was the name of the school at the time. I walk up the steps, and again, I cannot speak the language. So I memorized one phrase, my survival phrase. And every time somebody would speak, I would just say, I don't speak English, in a very heavy accent. I mean, I still have an accent. It was a lot heavier then. And until somebody approached me that could speak Spanish.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you're coming to America, you navigate the education system very well. You're the first in your generation, or, you know, first in your family, with a lot of achievements. And how supportive were your parents in that?
So I do want to share two things. Navigated it well, but I do have to tell you that my passion for equity in education stems from that experience of walking into that. I mean, that was the beginning, right? Walking into a school system here. Coming from Puerto Rico, I never experienced racism, stereotype. Never experienced that. Not that it doesn't exist in our island, because it does. But as a kid, right, I had never experienced it. It was the first time that I experience what it is for someone to treat you differently without knowing you, what it means for expectations to be set for you just because the color of your skin or just because you can't speak the language. So that was my first experience with the system. But I have to say that, fortunate enough, again, right, that my parents, although they could never sit with me at the table to help me do homework or explain things to me because they didn't understand the educational system themselves and they couldn't speak the language either, at least the messaging was always front and center from the moment that I can remember, that it was, they were very clear. You see your struggles, you don't have to struggle. Education is the way that you get to break the cycle of poverty. So you focus on education. Everything needs to be about your education. So the messaging was there, and I internalized that from early on.
You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. We are having a conversation with Superintendent of Schools, Dr. Madeline Negron, going through her youth and struggles.
Yes.
Now, that gives you an understanding of fiscal responsibility, huh?
It sure does, because I know what it is to be poor. I don't know what, I know what it means, right? The decisions that you have to make. Some days we can have this, some days we can't have that. Where is there another opportunity to stretch a dollar? So I've seen that firsthand. So I think I understand a little bit about that.
You let's now go through your career. Now you graduate college, you get your doctorate from UConn, right? Am I close?
You are correct.
Very good.
You are correct.
You get your doctorate, so go Huskies.
Yes, go Huskies.
How was it that college experience being the first of your family?
Right. Let me share another story before getting there, because getting to UConn was not an easy journey, right? Even when I began to get a handle on the English language, and I was blessed that I entered a school district which at the time had a bilingual education program. That's why I am a strong fan. I am an advocate of those programs. I've been a teacher in those programs because I know they work, right? I was blessed enough to enter that program that allowed me to continue to learn content while learning English and leveraging my own language as I transitioned to the high school. But my high school experience also was not an easy one because it was still learning the language and then seeing how inequitable the system is. I'm the kid that never once got access to an AP class. It would have come in handy, right? To go into an AP class, done well, earn the 3, so then I could transfer that course to college and save me some dollars. But I wasn't that kid. I didn't have access to a dual enrollment class, which again, you can take in high school. You do well, and I was always a good student. You earn the grade, that means you earn the college credit and you take it to the university. But I didn't have those opportunities. Nobody even got me prepared to even go and navigate the college application process. Lucky that we often have like a little angel, right? That it's beside us and kind of takes care of us. I had a few angels that took care of me, to at least walk me as much as they could through that process. But that meant that just to go to UConn that first year, I bombed the SATs because, again, I was still learning English. But luckily, they had those programs, right? I forget what they used to call them. If you were good academically and you had strong references, people would vouch for you. They would let you come in under the condition that you would spend the summer doing those courses, And that was contingent on you starting in the fall. So did that, did well that summer. And then my parents borrow money from everybody under the sun to pay for my first semester of college. Because nobody told them about, hey, you need to do FAFSA and you need to go find scholarships. So that's why I am a firm believer that we need to have school counselors, right? Not only school counselors, but they are a key to supporting our families with the college going process. But anyway, I make it to UConn. You know, UConn has always been large. It was hard. That first year, second year was hard.
As for many students yes, coming from,
it's, you know, hard.
It's not easy. This is your first introduction to the real world.
Yes.
You're away from home.
Yes.
No mommy and poppy around. So
it was hard. It was hard because I think, you know, I've always worked hard. Even though the courses were challenges, I did my best. It was just hard navigating those large freshman year classes. I mean, you're talking humongous upper stores, huge. And at the same time, you know, managing the load of college while still being a working at night. I worked all through high school and all through college to help pay for my college education. So that was hard. I went in thinking that I'm going to become a prosecutor. My dream was never to go into education. I had teachers tell me, Madeline, you in the high school, you would become a great teacher. I see it. I'm like, no way. No, they don't get paid enough. I said, look at you. You get abused all the time, but the kids. And on top of it, you don't get paid. I don't want anything to do with that. I thought I was going to be this, you know, top prosecutor. You know, I could even visualize it. And the realities, you know, set in that I couldn't afford college. And I just got mad at the system. I got so mad. I'm like, this could have been easier for me. Had education done better for me? If the system had done better for me. And eventually left UConn, transferred over to Central because it would have been cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I said, I'm going to major in education.
Mm.
Major in education, finished my bachelor's, went straight to teach back in the same community that I grew up in. Back into that same school where I said I don't speak English.
Mm.
Went to teach there to give back to kids. Continue my education. Went back to UConn to do my master's degree. By then I had figured it out where the grants are. Got that paid for. Didn't have to pay a cent. And, you know, just was doing teaching, doing it, having fun. While I was still mad about what the system didn't do for me.
You take that energy now and you become part of various institutions before, you know, throughout your career. What are some of the most memorable institutions that you've led?
So there eventually, you know, got my administrator certification from the state of Connecticut. I knew that I needed to get closer to policy if I was ever going to change the system or at least disrupt the system. So I become the first Latina principal in Willimantic, and I lead the middle school that I went to as a kid. But now it was at this beautiful facility that had been built. From there, eventually left that school after almost 11 years, came back to New Haven because I had been in New Haven before as a high school teacher, Career High School, but got to come back to be the principal at Career, at Hill Regional Career. Because I fell in New Haven the first time I came to New Haven as a teacher. New Haven was so good to me in terms of the opportunities. And became the principal of Career, went to central office, worked with early childhood, became a director of instruction, left New Haven to go to Hartford. and up there became the chief of academics, later got promoted to be the deputy superintendent of academics. And in between all of that, got together with a few colleagues, and we even founded our own nonprofit organization.
You're listening to 94.3 WYBC, The Rhythm of the City. This is the Electric Drum. I'm Jose Candelario here with Dr. Madeline Negron. Now, you started a nonprofit and with a group of friends.
It was a group of Latino administrators in New Haven in 2014. We started talking about how, you know, we see the Latino population growing across our state. Every time we look, like, we don't see an organization statewide that creates a space to have the honest conversation of what it means to either be a Latino student or be a leader, Latino leader inside of our systems. We couldn't find it. Mm-hmm. So we decided then to create our own. So we learned of a national organization called ALAS, and we decided to become an affiliate. And that's how we created this nonprofit that is now known as CALAS.
How did these previous positions prepare you for this new stage?
So I briefly mentioned, right, that my personal goal and also professional goal has been one that I want to make a change, and I want to make an impact for the experience that children have inside of our public education system. One that we know, right? It's a broken system. When we look at, and I'm talking now nationwide, it's just broken. As we look to rebuild it, and I believe it's going to take years to rebuild that system, I knew I needed to be closer to the table. Am I sitting at the table where decisions are made that impact, right, the opportunities that we afford our students? All of our students, I don't care what color they are, what language they speak, because everybody brings talent. That has been the driving force for me to, one, become a school principal, later want to become an executive administrator, later want to become a cabinet. And I always knew I want to be able to transform an urban environment. Top position in an urban environment means a superintendent. So I knew years ago, I wanted to prepare myself to be a superintendent. But I'm also a firm believer, and I think it comes from my upbringing, that I wanted to know firsthand the different things that happen inside of a public education system. Because I wanted to have firsthand knowledge to know how it runs or how it should run, and learn more about how it should run. I pride myself in that I know what teaching looks like and feels like because I've done it. I know the struggles of a teacher, that you bring all of that with you home. It's not people think that a teacher, you have the easiest job, you have the summers off, right? You have vacations off. I don't think if you haven't been a teacher, you don't fully understand what it means to be a teacher. I also know what it means to run a school system, a school building. Principal is key to ensuring that you create the culture that exists inside of that building. I also know that as an entire district, it's leadership that matters. Accounting for the school principals, the research is very clear. Because, right, we are the ones that are creating the culture that speaks about all the systems working together in alignment at the end of the day, not to do right by adults, but to do right by the children that we serve. So that's why it was important for me to have all those jobs that you see on my resume. That was intentional.
What have you learned? You got this position in July 2023. We're coming in close to your one-year anniversary.
Yes, it's been 10 months already. Can you believe that?
Time flies. When you're working hard.
Yes. I just hope it doesn't show. Like, I don't want to be like those presidents, right? You know that joke, they go in, they don't have gray hair, and within months, they're full of gray hair. Like, I hope I'm not one of those.
I mean, we can touch a little bit of how you maintain your youthful spirit. But what have you learned in this past year, now that you got your hands in the dirt?
So I would say 10 months in the job, but I started doing a lot of research even before I made the decision to apply for that national search. And once I got appointed, there was a lot of meetings, visits that I was doing. So all of that, right, making it very explicit that I wanted to come in. And even though I had been in the district before, I knew I need to take time and not make assumptions. I needed to come in. I needed to listen, truly listen, to understand what are the realities on the ground, especially also that we lived a pandemic, right? That turned our worlds upside down. And I'll tell you my learnings. I did a lot of research, like I mentioned. My first learning, I came in and my image of the district, remember, I used to be a principal at Career. And I remember how beautiful my building was and the condition that my building was in. My first surprise was like, surprise, buildings were falling apart. That was my first surprise. So I got a handle on a report that had been done in 2021 that did an analysis of our schools and that painted a very grim picture that says we're going to have to invest significant dollars to get these buildings back to conditions that are optimal for kids, right? That was one of my learnings. The other learnings in this 10 month is I had read, right, that there was committed and dedicated teachers and staff in our system. I have to say that through the process that I engaged in, even I didn't hire a company to come in and do an assessment. I said, hey, I've done research before. I hold a PhD. I know what it takes. I went into two schools myself. I spent the whole month of September and the bulk of October visiting every school because I wanted to see the staff, right? See the instruction, talk to principals, interview principals. And I can say it's true. We have committed, dedicated staff that want to do right by our kids. I also learned that there were some decisions that were made prior to me coming related to being able to align the way that we teach our kids, particularly reading and writing, to make sure that it's aligned to the science of reading. And that is something that I was doing in my previous role. So I was happy to see that. I was also happy to see that as a district, we took a lot of the federal dollars that came in and we invested those dollars to bring in the curricular instructional materials that our teachers need to be able to do the job. So those were all the things that I learned. But I've also learned that we have significant gaps that we have. Often joke around with friends who say, Madeline, you sure picked the right time to become a superintendent. Because this is the time when a lot of those financial supports, like they're gone, right? They're gone. ESSER dollars are gone. So part of the learning now is, what do I do to bring about sustainability to this district? That means that I now have to quickly navigate an ability to bring in all the information that I'm going to need to work with the community as a whole to think about what will that plan look like. The good thing is right now with the community, we're building our strategic operating plan. Very happy about that the community has been invested to say, yeah, happy to help you out. Yes, I want to be part of that design team. And I have about 66 people that are part of that team. So pretty soon we'll have a new strategic operating plan to talk about our priorities for the district. But now I also have to bring in a plan around sustainability as it relates to our buildings, our facilities, and the way we're going to fund everything.
You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. I'm Jose Candelario here with Dr. Madeline Negron. How do you find a way to bring quality educators for our students with the money you have?
Yeah, that's the greatest challenge. So right now, knowing where the numbers stand. So I'll give you an example. I just presented a budget to the alders, definitely asking a lot more than what the mayor has proposed in his budget. The mayor's budget, which is $5 million more for Board of Ed, that will at least allow me to meet the contractual agreements with the staff that we have, right? What I'm doing now is how do I hold on to the staff that I do have? And yeah, they deserve the contract that they got, right? Which did increase salaries a little bit to make them a little bit more compatible. We're still not there, but at least an attempt to make them more compatible. So my idea is, how do I hold on to the people that I have now? How do I right-size the district? So if I have two classrooms that I can combine, right, I can now take one of those full-time certified teachers, move them to an area where maybe I didn't have a teacher, take care of those vacancies, and hopefully save some dollars there, right? Every time that a vacancy comes up and I need to fill it and attract people, I'm trying to sell them, not so much on money, because the reality is I can't compete, right, as it relates to salaries. People will say, well, this district is going to give me $10,000 more. Well, I can't give you that. What I can give them is the promise of what we're trying to build, right? We're trying to build a district that is really going to think about how do we meet the needs of all of our kids, and because we embrace, right, the diversity that they bring and their multilingual skills that they bring. I'm trying to sell that, a district that is committed for all of us to work together. So I got to sell them on that, because on the money, I'm not going to be able to sell them. What I do need, though, eventually, is if I don't have a plan to start doing something about our facilities, like, who wants to work in these buildings that are not so nice, right? And I want our kids to be in buildings that are nice and conducive to being there, right? So I know all of that is part of retention. So I'm working a lot on what is my retention strategy.
Here's the next level of this. Our school system, for as long as I've known it, I'm also a graduate. We suffer from a disproportionate access to technology. Our children are not graduating with at least basic skills and coding and things of that nature, which is the future. How do you see the school system growing and gaining, technology that the students would advance their careers academically and professionally?
Well, I would say, let me start with the COVID years, right? If there's something to say positive that came out of the pandemic, is that it forced, right, educational systems to look more around what tools are out there to support children. So that allow, right, for more things to come in, increase the capacity of our teachers to use technology and embed it within our curriculum. So I would say that's a plus, right? So that's why you see more Chromebooks now, more tools in our school systems. But in terms of curriculum, like you're talking about, like coding and things like that, I would say there's also things that have happened at the state level that does require, like, computer science to be taught in schools now. So those are things now, right, that we are building and providing for children. Those are things also that I want to bring about when I speak about, and the community has heard me talk about, my interest in not only college, but career pathways, right? I want to put a lot of emphasis in that area, because I believe it's about preparing kids for college, but not everybody is going to college. How can I prepare them also for career? And things like all these careers that you are mentioning right now that involve technology. But there are opportunities that we could do inside of our schools right now that have business pathways. We have them right now in our system. I want to be able to go deeper in those pathways, expand them, so I can bring our kids top-notch, right? Top-notch experiences that they can graduate with, like, certificates. They can go straight into jobs or go straight, do 2 more years, and you're done. But all of that goes back to investments. If the dollars are not there, all I have are the dollars just to keep the lights on, because I can't make new investments. So that's the challenge right now that I am facing. Despite everything that I have learned, and I will continue to look for opportunities, those are the challenges that I'm facing.
Test scores.
Test scores, yes.
State test scores, where it comes to arithmetic and reading in our city, is, I would dare to say, deplorable.
I agree with you.
For a number of years. What is your approach to curriculum versus your approach to teaching? And I mean, is it the teachers or the curriculum, or is it both? How do you attack this?
I define it as the instructional core. And the instructional core consists of a lot of things, because it talks about teacher, student, curriculum, right? Those three things intersecting. But all those things intersect because you have another layer outside of that, right, on how the district is supporting all those things that are needed for a teacher, right, to continue to build their capacity, because we're never done learning. That's why you see all those years of education in my resume, and I still continue to seek out learning. We're never done. The materials, are we putting the right materials in the hands of our teachers so they have what they need to teach students? Also, students. Are students coming in? We find more and more students who are coming in with complex, I want to say complex issues, right? Sometimes you saw all over the place issues related to chronic absenteeism. I can have a top-notch teacher. I can give that teacher the best curriculum materials I have. That kid doesn't come to school, there's nobody to teach. When that kid takes a test, how do you think that kid is going to perform? So there are issues everywhere. But to go back to your question, though, I do want to highlight the fact that when I came in July, I also came in and I hit the ground running. Because I had looked at those assessments, and having been a chief academic officer, I know that those things need to improve. They have to improve, right? Immediately, I named 2 priorities. Said I'm going to hone in on student engagement, meaning let's get our kids to school every day. Let's, you know, increase our attendance, reduce our chronic absenteeism. That means the number of kids that lose 10% of their school days in a year. Right. So that has been priority one, number one. And number two, I've been all over literacy. How is it that we are preparing our teachers to understand, right, what the teacher now said, the research says around the science of reading? How are we supporting them? How is our curriculum matching that? How are we doing the professional development? And how is that actually happening in the classroom? So I've been all over attendance and all over literacy to continue to support our teachers in being able to do that.
One more tough subject to touch on: violence in our school system, mm-hmm. bullying. Mm-hmm. I mean, these things lead to chronic absenteeism.
Yes.
What are the steps have you taken to remediate some of these symptoms?
There's a lot, and I'm glad you're bringing up that question. So thank you for that opportunity to be able to share my response to that. As a system, we're sitting inside of a city, right, that's dealing with a lot of issues. All those issues that happen out in the community, they all come into our schools, right? So we can't pretend that nothing that's happening outside of our doors is not happening inside of our doors. That is why we have to have intentionality in how we are partnering with the community resources to support, so that we know what's happening, all that violence that's happening, and how that might show itself inside of our schools. so that then again, we have the proper personnel to be able to support with that, starting with our security guards, right? Keeping us safe, but also the social workers that are talking to the kids, the counselors that are talking to the kids, all the supports that gotta go into supporting children that we know are in a, I'm gonna say in crisis. There's a crisis that is happening. But all of that, again, we need to work hand in hand with community to support that work, which I believe we're doing, right? We are doing, we will continue to do. Second, I would say, also need families to help us out. I said it from day one, we cannot do this alone. I would be naive if I get in front of you as a superintendent and say, we got it. I got my people, we got it. No, we don't have it. This has to be done with community, the entire community, city, churches, business, chamber, everybody, right? Everybody has to be part of the solution because these are community issues that are coming into a school. Now, when things happen, take bullying, for example. Bullying has a very clear definition set up by the state, right? So although we want to call everything bullying, not everything is bullying according to definition. Are there issues that happen all the time with kids that continue to build and build and build and build and get ugly? Now we're talking bullying, right? We got to get ahead of it as soon as it starts. So when we know there's conflict between children, we can immediately intervene and get support to make sure that those conflicts don't continue to build, right? That's one thing. But second, I'm going to take the opportunity to say, I need parents to help out. I'm going to be honest with you right now. Yes, we have these issues among kids. You see the fights happening everywhere, not only outside of schools, but also in schools. You see those all the time. Very quick to just fight. We hear often, you call families because part of our work is to come in, mediate, right? Inside of a mediation, family saying, well, did you hit her? Did you hit her hard enough? Did you hit him hard enough? That's the mentality of adults telling our children or encouraging our children to fight. I'm sorry, but that is not parenting, right? Second, I have an issue. Parents coming into building, threatening staff. We can't have that. Are we gonna have issues? Yes. Do we wanna solve issues? Yes. I have said from day one, families have to be our true partners. We have to communicate with families because they know their children best. They're their first teachers. But families, you gotta help us out. You can't let frustrations get to you and you're coming in to threaten people. That's not how I was raised. That's not how we behave.
Times have changed.
Times have changed.
We are running out of time. Thank you so much. One last thought that you want to share with the community?
Yes, thank you to you for this opportunity to be here. I wanna thank the community for welcoming me in this role. I've received nothing but support from both inside the organization and outside. And I just want the public to know I am here to work hard, working with my administration. I am going to seize every opportunity to stretch the dollar so that we're being fiscally responsible. But at the end of the day, I want to make sure that we are realizing the promise of a public education. It worked for me. And I want to make sure that it works for your children.
You have been listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, The Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario, here with a great in-depth conversation with our Superintendent of Schools of New Haven, Ms. Madeline Negron. And like always, I thank you for your time and your listen. This is WYBC and the community 24/7, 365.
Thank you.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the East and North sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, for prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.